last Sunday, I mentioned that Michelle and I had spent a very enjoyable week with my family in Charleston, West Virginia, between Christmas and New Year's. The family, in this case, being my mother, my two sisters and their husband and a nephew. I have a third sister, also lives in Texas. That was a bit far for them to make this time around. My father passed away several years before I began my ministry here. The night before the flight that Michelle and I had to get us back to Manchester and down here to Nashua, that whole crowd of us gathered for a Chinese takeout dinner at my mother's condominium. And once we had properly stuffed ourselves and were finishing off coffee and dessert, my mother came out with a large manila envelope with a lot of old and quite worn pieces of paper in it, said she had some things that she wanted to show us. And it was a pretty amazing collection that she laid out on the table. It was all this stuff that she saved, and I didn't even know she had saved, but had to do with her and with me getting into this country from England by way of the Queen Mary in February of 1946. My mother was 19 at the time. I was all of 6 months. I know some of you have heard the backstory on this, but I'll just do it very briefly. My mother was a British war bride as in World War II. My father, who grew up in rural West Virginia, served in the United States Navy. They met in Plymouth, England, sometime in early, mid-1943, got married in August of 44. I was born a year later, near the end of August of 1945, just as the war was ending. So technically speaking, therefore, I missed being a baby boomer by 4 months and 1 week. Because the official start of the boomer era, as decreed by those demographers who decree such things, is January the 1st of 1946. I didn't quite make it, so don't blame me for putting the Social Security system in peril, along with all the other things that the post-World War II boomer generation seems to be getting blamed for right now. Anyway, to get back to my mother's table. In the waning days of 2010, what she had saved, going back 65 years, as I say, was all the documentation she and my father had to deal with to get the two of us, my mother and me, on the boat across the ocean and into the United States. My dad couldn't travel with us because he had to return to the United States with his Navy unit so he could be formally discharged. There was one little sheet of paper there that had to do all these regulations about how much baggage my mother could bring on, including a diaper limit. And a signed and sworn statement by my father demonstrating that he could support the two of us when we arrived in this country. Indeed, Dad did have a test to having a job waiting for him in Southern Ohio that would pay him the whopping sum of $114 a month. Mom had even kept all these mimeographed daily newspapers that were run off for the passengers on the five-day voyage. They were faded to the point of barely being readable, but they were fascinating nonetheless. And I know I could, in fact, devote the remainder of this sermon to all the contents of that envelope, but maybe some other time for that. For as we passed those fragile and faded pieces of paper around that table about 10 days ago, it called up for me thoughts I have had many times when it comes to, when it comes to my existence. These thoughts mostly have to do with the leap into the unknown that my mother was taking. My mom is a very small woman. She's been here a few times. Some of you have met her. I doubt she's ever weighed much over 100 pounds at any time in her life. But even now, as she approaches her 85th birthday, she is anything but frail and never has been. For really, it does knock me out that an 18-year-old woman who had never been more than 50 miles from her English home and who had never lived anywhere other than in her family home would marry a 34-year-old American sailor with an 8th-grade education whom she had known for less than a year, have his kid set off on a 3,000-mile ocean voyage to a country she knew nothing about and become a part of a family, all of whom were complete strangers to her. Of course, if she hadn't done all that, you'd be listening to somebody else up here speaking. And I've asked her about this a few times. And while I haven't put it in these exact words, my question to her in essence always comes out something like, "Good God, Mom, what were you thinking?" As I say, to put it that way would mightily tick my mother off. I don't want to do that, so I do find ways of putting it a little more diplomatically. No matter how I put it, though, I always get the same almost offhand kind of answer, which was, "Well, I was in love with your father. There was a big war going on. Nobody really knew what was going to happen or where things were going to go, so I decided to go for some adventure." Well, I don't know if raising four kids in a hard, scrabble southern West Virginia setting was exactly what she had in mind when she talked about going for adventure, but that was what she got. And I can see how, when I think about that, I can see how, with all of the uncertainties that such a catastrophic war brought on, especially for young people who were feeling its effects directly, and my mother was living right, literally on the front line, she saw bombs fall on her native city there of Plymouth, I would imagine there was probably some kind of a sense of sort of mooring slipping loose, or maybe some tectonic plates shifting around, and the sense was then to go for whatever you feel is out there for you and see where it leads. You might as well. I think that's probably how it looked to 18-year-old Marjorie Northcott in 1943 and 1944, being essentially in the middle of a war zone. Well, many years later, several decades actually, after I had come to know my mother's story, I encountered some lines in a poem by the late Reverend Rick Maston that I felt spoke to her story pretty well. "It's only in uncertainty that true hope can be found. You can bet a sure thing will always let you down." My mother did place her personal hopes in a lot of uncertainty. Whether or not she was going to be let down when she got on the Queen Mary, she didn't know anything but certain. But in a way, I would think that the reason she did what she did, for in a way, our post-Christmas gathering was for her a confirmation and an affirmation that opting for uncertainty was the right move for her after all. And she was, as we could all tell, sitting there quite proud, and justifiably so, of her story. And while Reverend Maston's words, for me, do make me think of my mother's life choices, Rick wrote them out of a very different kind of a story that he was living when he put the words to paper. And we'll turn to that now. For the poem is contained in a line, the poem in which the lines are contained is called "A Word for Survival." Like the poet we heard from a little earlier with the reading that Harry did, Rick also wrote this shortly after he was diagnosed with an inoperable form of prostate cancer. Let me give you another quick backstory here for those who may not be familiar with Reverend Maston and my connection with him. From the late 1960s until his death nearly 3 years ago, Rick was a Unitarian Universalist troubadour minister, poet, and songster, working and traveling from his lifelong home in Carmel, California, where he was once named that city's poet laureate. His best-known signature song is "Let It Be a Dance." It's in our hymnal. Well, shortly after a presentation, some of you were here for that, I think, in the fall of 2005, Rick did one of his poetry reading presentations here at the church. It was his last East Coast tour, as it turned out. And in the course of his visit, he and I decided to collaborate on a book about his life and his very unique ministry within our Unitarian Universalist movement. And I managed to get it written and published 2 years later. And we had a wonderful book launch party at his and his wife, Billy Barber's home in Carmel, California, in January of 2008. This is the book that he and I got out and worked on together. That was, I say, the party was at his home church, January of 2008. Rick died 5 months later, in May of that year, some 9 years after getting his initial cancer diagnosis. "A Word for Survival" is one of several poems cited in the chapter in this book about how getting his cancer diagnosis changed the nature and the tone of his ministry. We titled the chapter, "The Ministry I've Been Preparing For All My Life." I'm going to read a few lines from the poem now, and I'll return to more of it later. Fear, the silent assassin, will bring you to your knees, while faith can pull Excalibur from stubborn stones with ease. The outcome of any illness is never absolute. No matter what the odds are, the end is always moot. It's only in uncertainty that true hope can be found, and you can bet a sure thing will always let you down. With respect to those last two lines, which I've now recited, I think, twice in the past 10 minutes or so, I guess I should take a time out here long enough to round up the usual caveats and get them out of the way. Yes, we all have to have what I'll call operational certainties in order to just get from one day to the next. When this service and coffee hour are over today, I can say with a high degree of certainty I will get in the same car I drove here in, return to the same house in which I've lived for over 20 years, a house I share with my wife, to whom I've been married for over 30 years. We, all of us, would not be able to function if we were to wake up every morning with nothing but a maze, haze, and mishmash of uncertainty, as if all the parts of our lives were in place when we went to bed the night before were not there in place the next morning. I get that. What we also know, is how tenuous and fragile those operational certainties, necessary as they are, can be. It's a tenuousness that can range from the merely inconvenient, like maybe I'll get a flat tire on the way home, all the way to the painful, tragic, and devastating. Indeed, it is the sudden, unexpected loss, the crisis, the painful turn of events that remind us of how tissue thin those operational certainties can be at times. We've certainly witnessed that just in the past 24 hours. Fragile and thin or not, however, we need these operational certainties in place, as just noted, in order to get from one day of our lives to the next. So where then is the truth in Rick's lines, "It's only in uncertainty that true hope can be found, and you can bet a sure thing will always let you down"? Paradoxical as that may sound, those few lines constitute a profound statement of faith. Yeah, I'm calling it a statement of faith. Go back from these lines in the poem to some that preceded them a few lines earlier. Fear, the silent assassin, will bring you to your knees, while faith can pull Excalibur from sudden stones with ease. Using a little King Arthur imagery there, as in pulling Excalibur's sword from the stone, Rick gives us faith as the opposite of fear and as the opposite of certainty. He puts in a good word for faith and then goes on to say, "A sure thing will always let you down." That could come as a surprise for those who equate having faith with having a sense of certainty. I'm with Rick, though, in regarding faith as the opposite of certainty. I'll explain it this way. While I was not personally raised in a strictly fundamentalist religion, it was conservative but not quite fundamentalist, I still grew up in a culture where Christian fundamentalism was very strong and very pronounced. And what I came to see, once I was able to take a few steps back from that milieu and view it with some kind of objectivity, was that fundamentalism, whatever brand of religion it may appear in, is essentially a religion of insecurity and uncertainty, usually with some elements of fear thrown in there. In some of its more extreme forms, it is a clinging, a desperate kind of clinging to something, the literal truth of the Bible, or whatever text one may take as sacred, or as clinging to a specifically delineated set of God's truths, largely out of fear of what terrible things might happen should one lose or even loosen his or her grasp on them. I won't go so far to say that this is the case for every single person who considers him or herself a fundamentalist. But when I see someone who has to be so insistent that he or she has the unadulterated truth as summed up in rote precepts, I have to wonder, what's behind that insistence? And usually, somewhere deep down, is a deep uncertainty that maybe I don't have it all locked up after all. And rather than admit that, I'll keep on insisting on my possession of the complete truth, and I'll congregate with others who feel the same way, so I'll feel confirmed my certitude. Well, be it far from me to tell someone they shouldn't have such a stance. It's just that in such a stance, I see no real or honest faith. Who needs faith, after all, when you have certainty? Now, I happen to think that kind of certainty is really an illusion. I'll also know that those who are living by such illusions, as I'm calling them, really don't care what I think. But that's okay, and we'll let it go. Get back to the poem. For faith, as I have come to understand it, and as Rick uses the term in this poem of his, is a willingness to live with uncertainty. It is to live with the knowledge that an alleged sure thing may well let you down at times. It is a willingness to live with mystery and with the unknown while trusting in one's abilities to meaningfully probe at the mystery and at the unknown. Discovering and living out what one can while still knowing you'll never quite get the whole thing. In addition, faith is the choice to live as if certain things are true in the absence of sure knowledge. I'll go back to my work with Rick as an example. In January of 2007, 4 years ago this month, I spent about a week with him at his home in Carmel, working on some of the still unfinished parts of our book here about his life and ministry. And while I was there, I also visited the Unitarian Universalist Church in Carmel to see if they would host a publication party 1 year hence, in January of 2008. That's why I mentioned earlier. I figured, correctly, that that would give us enough time to get the book completed and published. Now, the Carmel UUs were good to go with the idea, even as they were in the process of calling a new minister at that time. And when I passed the news on to Rick, just as I was getting ready to head home, his somewhat rueful response was, said only the way he could say something like this, "Well, I guess this means I have to live another year." So we continued working towards the completion of the book. And with the support, the enthusiastic support of the minister of the Carmel UUs called a few months later in early 2007. And we planned the party. We did all of that as if they were going to happen. And we made it with 5 months to spare. And when I think about the many things the phrase journey of faith can mean, one of the things I recall is those 12 months from January of 2007 to January of 2008. With their mixture of uncertainty and hope, knowing that we couldn't bet on a sure thing, but proceeding as if we could. And in this case, the hopes were fulfilled. Well, I'm going to make one more pass at this poem we've been exploring before wrapping it up for today. Remember, again, the title is A Word for Survival. I haven't told you yet what the specific word is that Rick offers. The poem, taken in its entirety, is a tribute to a man Rick met as a fellow cancer battler and for a time survivor. His name was William Hoyt. By the time Rick wrote the poem, Mr. Hoyt had passed away. But here's a part of the poem that Rick writes about his late compadre, Bill Hoyt. He fought the big sea monster with spunk and attitude. Another cockeyed optimist you should not conclude. So like the fallen colors, I've taken up his word, and I'll shout it from the hilltop till the echo can be heard. He was no Pollyanna, his word no platitude. To things considered saccharine, he could be abrupt and rude. In present-day vernacular, he was a righteous dude. Let's hear it for the man who coined the word spiritude. And that was Rick and Bill Hoyt's word for survival. Spiritude. As you can probably figure out, it's a mix or an amalgam of the words spirit and attitude. Spiritude, not bad. It speaks to a life stance that one can take, knowing that hope is found in the ability and the willingness to live with uncertainty. It's a stance I have referred to in other sermons as trustful agnosticism. That is to say, a willingness to live in the flow of life, and trusting in the direction of that flow, and trusting as well in one's ability to steer your way through that flow without complete and ultimate and once and for all final answers as to what that flow is all about and where it's finally going. That's trustful agnosticism. So, spiritude. It's a trusting attitude towards a life guided by the Spirit. You can call that spirit whatever you will. The human spirit, the life spirit, spirit of the universe, spirit of God, whatever feels most authentic to you. For that is one of the things that we are about here. And that is encouraging you, each one of you, to find and live out your personal authenticity on the strength and on the force of your own spiritude. And I am sure that we can continue to do that. So let's sing together hymn number 86, Blessed Spirit of My Life.